Welcome. This is the Life Habits Podcast series. My name is Carl Vredenberg.
And my name is Paige Herron.
This is the series that helps you to learn new habits to optimize your life and embrace an enlightened, healthy, and prosperous lifestyle. And today, we're going to be talking about honing your leadership skills. And I'm joined by Joe Byerly, the founder of My Green Notebook, a platform for leaders to help each other by sharing lessons and including Joe's own lessons from his over 20 years of leadership in the U.S. Army. Welcome to the Life Habits Podcast, Joe.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. And just a point of clarification. So the book that I co-authored a couple of years ago is called My Green Notebook. Our platform, the blog itself, is called From the Green Notebook. And I wanted to call it My Green Notebook, but when I was looking for domain names at a time, My Green Notebook was already taken. So I had to go with From the Green Notebook.
Thanks for that clarification. So it's, it's a book and a platform and a podcast, right?
Correct.
All called the same thing.
I mean, do you know why it's called Green Notebook?
Yeah, maybe you can explain that.
I will. Yeah. So in the military, everything's issued. So everything's, you know, we go to a supply room and you can get pens, pencils, whatever you need to do your job. And notebooks is part of that. These are green notebooks that are in supply rooms across the military, regardless of service. It says Federal Supply Service on the bottom of them. I remember getting my first one and thinking it was a really big deal over 20 years ago. And so for us in the military, it's where we take notes for meetings. It's where we do our to-do list. It's where we have something, you know, called the after-action review. After a mission or after a training exercise, we sit down and kind of go through our lessons learned very systematically. We write those in there. And then just general insights and thoughts that we have throughout the day. So, you know, for me, this green notebook's kind of been like a Swiss Army knife, you know, for my thoughts over the last 20 years. So for that website, the platform has been amazing because we've had people from all over, not just the U.S. military, but our allies and partners in NATO to contribute leadership articles really over the last decade. And that's the origin of the name or the etymology of the name Green Notebook.
Well, thanks so much for that clarification. And in fact, I guess it's that green notebook that even inspired some of the things we're going to talk about in terms of journaling, because you've been journaling for more than 20 years as a result as well. But we'll get into that. We have a lot of leaders that listen to this podcast and aspiring leaders. So I'm sure they're thrilled to hear you talk about your experience and what you advise with regard to leadership. Before we get into those details, it'd be great to go through, as we usually do, some quotes that you brought with you.
I've got three quotes today. The first one, I'm not sure when I came across it. I found a notebook from 2014 the other day, and I had written it down in there, but it's from E.M. Forster. It's how I start the podcast off, and I put it all over everything, but it's how do I know what I think till I see what I say? I'm not really sure what he meant when he wrote it, but what I've taken that and pulled that into is that unless we write something down, we really don't know what we think. And so that's kind of been the guiding quote for everything that I've done, just not only with From the Green Notebook, but also in my leadership journey. So that's the first quote. The second quote in the same vein, it's from one of my favorite authors, Stephen Pressfield. And he says, "Writing is weird medicine. I sit down not knowing what I believe, and I get up knowing." Again, this idea of, you know, being able to take the time to sit down and write your thoughts out. And then the last one is from Seth Godin. And this one I think is really important because you were very busy at IBM, obviously, for the last couple of decades. I've been busy in the military. And so there's a lot of people out there that quickly, when you talk about reading, you talk about journaling, you talk about writing, there's, "Well, I don't have time." And Seth Godin has this quote that says, "You don't need more time. You simply need to decide." And that's also been kind of a guiding principle for me and all the side projects I've done over the last decade with the blog, the newsletters, and the podcast.
Great set of quotes. And we're going to dig into some more of those details in a minute as well. So tell us a little bit to begin with about your career as a leader. What attracted you to the role of leadership? And what do you consider have been the greatest benefits to you personally of being a leader?
My background came from a middle-class family. You know, college was something that I didn't start talking about till it was time to go to college. And I just kind of really wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. My uncle had served, my grandfather served in the military, and I saw the respect that was given to them and just how proud of their service, but also from a financial standpoint, I saw that, you know, they had been able to rise above kind of like where they were at, where they were born into through military service. And so I was like, okay, this is the thing that I want to do. So I went to the University of North Georgia. I went to college in 1999 is when I started. And then in 2000, got a 3-year Army ROTC scholarship that basically took care of the bills and gave me a stipend each month. And so it was kind of like, I'll go try this thing for a little bit, kind of like you. I think you plan to work at IBM for a year and it took you another 35 years to leave the company. Same with me. I was only going to be there for a few years and eventually ended up there for 2 decades. And it was the leadership, the people, the mission. I had some amazing experiences over the course of 20 years that grew me and made me into the person I am. And I'm a huge fan. Are you familiar with Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's this idea that we have to go out and experience something that, you know, this crucible in our life that's really going to sharpen us, change us, and really bring forth that gift that we have. And for me, the military was my hero's journey for the last 2 decades, which is, you know, brought me to this conversation we're having right now.
So I have been reading your material. I came across this quote that I want to share with you and have you comment on. I watched people get promoted who didn't deserve it and saw other well-deserving leaders' careers end too soon. There were times I worked for toxic leaders who made coming to work agonizing. On several occasions, my personal life was upended by a passing comment made by a senior leader, quickly turned into an order by an overeager staff officer who is ready to impress. When I was leading leaders, and I've done that for many years, as you observed, I would often say leaders are people too. We need to actually think about and care about what their experiences are. And how do you deal, and how did you deal with the demands of being a senior leader? It's often a very lonely experience. How did you deal with that from a day-to-day point of view?
I'll back up a little bit too, you know, with that comment. One of the things in the military, it's an up or out organization. And so, you know, I had this conversation with Annie Duke on the podcast about knowing when to walk away. And a couple of years ago, I started paying attention to myself again because I had the daily practice of journaling. Things were changing inside of me and it was going to be time pretty soon to move on. So made the decision, and I made the decision with a long runway ahead of me. I think I still had, you know, at least 10 years left of a career in the military. I could have done 36 like you, but I just felt like it wasn't right for me anymore. And I needed to walk away, and I made that decision. Because I made that decision, I could step back and start observing the people around me. And I had some tough conversations, you know, with peers and even people who, you know, were older than me in the military who got passed over. And it's really interesting because you watch these people who used to be very fired up, you know, for the profession of arms, and all of a sudden they get passed over and it's like their world just crashes down on them. And so I just wanted to write that in there to you know, just put in there that like, it's not always a perfect path in the military, because a lot of younger folks, they look up and they see stuff like that happen, or they work for a, you know, bad boss and then they leave the service. But what I learned was you can take when it comes to toxic leadership, especially, you can take those lessons that you learn working for somebody like that. And that was the fuel that was behind my leadership over the last 2 years as I was leading this organization of about 500 people in Europe. So I just wanted to provide that background. But to your question, leadership is not easy. Arthur Brooks, I think, said it best on the podcast, and I interviewed him right at the beginning of my command. And he said, the leader is the most objectified person in the organization. So as you know, you walk in, you are having a bad day, nothing related to anybody at work. And all of a sudden, people internalize your emotions and they believe that they did something wrong, or, you know, they're doing something wrong. And so it's a very weird position to be in, and especially in the military. Again, it's very hierarchical. I could walk in a room and the entire room would get quiet and look at me. And that was really hard. Another great quote I heard was that leadership is like living in a fishbowl on a firing range. And so I think for me personally, it was, having relationships, people that were very close with me that I could talk to about the things I was going through, having that community, that support network. And again, in leadership, that's not within your own organization. It's like outside of it, because you have to be conscious of the power dynamics. So that aspect of it was really heavy for me, Carl, because like when I walked into the job, I'm Joe. I've always been Joe. Nothing's changed. But to all of those folks, I was the boss. You know, I was a person that could make or break careers. I was a person who could ruin their day or put them out at training on the weekend. And so it was very hard for me to work with. I think, you know, going back to it, doing things, having that community, but also doing things that helped kept me grounded. So I had to leave for work every morning at, I think it was about 5:40 in the morning. And so I got up every morning at 4:40, 4:30, 4:40 a.m. to journal and read, because those were the two activities that I could quiet my mind right before I went into this role I was playing for the next 12 to 14 hours. And so I think, you know, for leaders who are in these positions, like what is the thing that keeps you grounded? You know, whether it's a family cookout, it's a game night, it's reading, it's journaling, it's biking, whatever it is, I think we have to prioritize that and make time in our schedule for that. One more story. I was talking with Erin Wade, CEO of a mac and cheese restaurant, Homeroom. She's a best-selling author. I think she recently sold the restaurant a few years ago after a decade for millions of dollars. And so her and I were talking, and she would go surfing like once a week. And at first, that was her thing. Like that grounded her, and that kind of, you know, poured back into her in that job. First, she would lie about it. She would tell people she was going to a doctor's appointment and whatever. And, you know, the thing that we came to was that eventually she told people she's going surfing and this is why. And it actually gave the people who worked for her permission to go do those activities for themselves. And it was the same for me. I would be very vocal about the things that filled me up. And hey, I'm going to go do those things and be unapologetic about them. So that's another aspect of the things that I did do. I knew that I was not only modeling behavior, but I was also giving permission to everybody else in the organization that you can do those things too.
I want to amplify a few of the things you just said there. I think they were really impactful. And, you know, one is to have somebody to confide in, especially if you're in an organization where you can't easily talk about openly what it is that you have on your mind. I had a chief of staff for many years that I could completely confide in. That was incredibly important, being a leader. And the other one is to stay grounded. And like you said, various practices. And in my case, I would never schedule a meeting before 10 o'clock in the morning because I would have my time to write and read, much like you were describing. I would blog actually in the mornings as well. And having time for yourself, as you pointed out, great advice. So as you mentioned, and everybody on this podcast knows, I retired after some 36 years working at IBM as a design executive. You've retired fairly recently, actually, from the military. What was the hardest part of retiring for you? And what advice would you give anyone about that decision and how to effectively retire, especially as a senior leader?
Yeah, for me, honestly, like doing the work of journaling and the hero's journey, like I think a lot of people, this wasn't something that I wrestled with, but as I've talked to people, I realized they wrestled with is the identity problem, is because your identity is wrapped up in the role that you play. And so when it's time to retire, when it's time to walk away from whatever you're doing, whether it's military or the corporate world, or even being a professional athlete, you're having to tear your identity away from that role. And then, you know, you're just Carl and I'm just Joe. You know, you're no longer, you know, the executive. I'm no longer the military leader. And so a lot of people wrestle with that, but I did a lot of journaling. I did a lot of reading. And then the study that I've done over the last couple of years using the model of the hero's journey really helped me pull myself away from that. So that's the first thing. But for me personally, it was the idea of the unknown. And my wife and I, we've been joking about it the last couple of days of like, up until I would say a couple of weeks ago, no idea how things were going to work out financially, you know, once I retired and we're okay. But there was just that fear of the unknown because, you know, especially in the military environment where your paycheck is guaranteed every month. And now that I'm, you know, doing the entrepreneurial thing, like that's no longer the case. So for us, it was this idea of the unknown, like what does our quality of life look like? But, you know, we made some smart decisions early on to where now, like, it worked out. But there's like 7 months of anxiety there leading up to this date. But everything else, it's been great. Like, being in a leader for me, it was like a walking around with a 45-pound plate, weighted plate all the time. Because I was always worried. The culture of the organization was very important for me. So I was always on the lookout for anything that would hurt the culture of that organization. And so that was a pretty big load to carry. So I was, I felt like, you know, because the cortisol levels were higher, I was tired a lot. You know, I had to work even harder to be the best version of myself every day. And, you know, as you know, because just because you're in a bad mood doesn't mean you can bring that into the workplace with you, right? So as soon as I got out of that position and now was able to focus on myself and my family, it's amazing. Like, I have so much energy now. You know, I work out several times a day, I'm getting paid to do the thing that I was doing in my free time. So life's pretty good right now. What about for you?
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's been similar for me. A bunch of constraints of things that I couldn't do before. And especially as a leader, you're looked on, as you said, as the person that needs to uphold the appropriate values and beliefs of an organization. And I still have my own personal ones, but they aren't necessarily always the same as the organization, right? And so that is now what I am doing as well. I'm leading about the same number of people, about 300 people in a voluntary capacity for this project called Habits for a Better World, researchers, designers, and filmmakers. In many ways, it's still leadership in the same way that we did before. I just don't get paid for it. It's a nonprofit. But at the same time, I can use all the benefits of what I learned about being a leader, but now I'm doing it. A good friend actually characterized it as, I used to work and do things for my wallet, and now I'm feeding my soul. That's kind of the transformation there. But I wanted to reinforce what you did say before, that as a leader, you're looked to and you can set the tone of the organization with your attitude, your overall demeanor, and even things like how hard you work. The place I worked, we use Slack as a way of communicating. Same thing with the nonprofit now. I always make sure that I don't have my green I'm on light on at all times, right? Even send like an email at a weird time. I have to work that way some of the time, but yeah. I don't want to give that impression that everybody else should be working like that. And I hear the same kind of thing from you as well.
That, I think, like, that was so important. I think I wrote about it years ago, but I got it from Todd Henry. This idea that every organization has ghost rules, and it's the things that aren't said explicitly that everybody in the organization just fills in the blank. So in the military, you will be rewarded for being the hardest worker and staying the latest. Not necessarily the smartest worker, the most effective worker. And so, you know, for me, I would leave every day between like 5 and 5:30, which is crazy talk, you know, in a lot of organizations in the military. And I was like, we will not text, we will not email after the duty day. And so that was really hard to, like, I go in and really change a lot of people's mindsets who've been doing that for the last 10, 15 years. And so it was a lot of work, really, you know, setting the tone. You go from your office, you know, down to the motor pole in the military, you're going to pass 10, 15 people of all ranks and ages who work for you. And, you know, as a leader, that may be the one time of day that this person sees you. And so if you just, like, ignore them, you know, if you don't say hello or whatever, then that's their view of you and a larger, you know, more macro view of the organization itself. So it was a little bit of like that science, but it was also like the art, the theater of leadership, you know, to do that. But you could see when we would go to the field, we would do training exercises, when we would participate in competitions, you could see the fruit of that. Or when you see somebody, you know, that get in trouble and then rebound from that and do even better the second time, you get to see the fruits of that. And so it sounds, you know, I think very simple just talking about it, but cognitively and emotionally, like, that's a lot. Especially, you know, for me, it was only 2 years. And, you know, I know for you and other executives, like, it could be a long time when you're in those roles and positions.
So where did you learn the really good techniques and approaches that you're talking about now? Like even this one of that you're seen by your staff as setting the tone, for example, was it experiential? Like when you first realized that, oh my God, if I have a lousy day, I'm affecting everybody else's mood. I mean, where did you learn that?
I learned it from reading and examples. Those are the two places. And one of the things that I like to talk about is that, you know, for all of us, especially when you go into a leadership position, you really are going into with like a single lens. And that lens is made up of coaches, parents, teachers, authority figures from the first part of your life, your adolescence. And so if you're not careful, you're only going to add very small bits and pieces to that lens over the course of a 10, 15, you know, 30 year career, if you're going off of experience alone. And so for me, I feel like reading is this way to kind of build up this jukebox of experiences, of lenses that you can pull from. When I went to these positions, not only was it my own experience and things that I saw in my career, I was pulling stuff from Plutarch, from Ed Catmull of Disney Pixar, from Kim Scott. I mean, like I was really pulling in all these leaders that weren't even in the military into that leadership position. And then I got lucky in the military because of my writing. I got selected over the course of my career to work for some really iconic U.S. Army generals like H.R. McMaster, Scott Miller, and Chris Donahue, and along with Air Force General Scott Howe. So I got to watch these guys and earn a PhD in leadership, you know, being in their front offices for about a 3-year period. And so I was able to take all that and bring that into, you know, for example, General Miller, 4-star general, head of all the forces in Afghanistan. He stayed there for 3 years. Whenever he went around, he would shake everybody's hand. If he was landing in Nangarhar province, going to go meet with somebody, on the way from the helicopter to that meeting, he would shake every soldier's hand and just ask how they were doing. Very small gesture, right? Very small. But for those men and women, that was a really big deal that this 4-star general would take the time to look them in the eye and shake their hand. So you would see stuff like that and you just kind of file it away and say, hey, when I'm in charge, this is what I'm going to take with me. Another example, when Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, I was in Poland with the 82nd Airborne Division and Major General, at the time, Major General Chris Donahue. And we deployed a brigade from the division over. You know, we got soldiers in the woods. It's February in Poland, which is very cold. You know, snow's on the ground. They're in camps with campfires, whatever, getting ready for whatever may happen, you know, providing options, you know, to the commander in chief. And he would walk around with a map. And I can't tell you how many times I saw him do this. He would get on the ground, unfold the map, and explain to these 19 and 20 year old soldiers what we were doing over there, what he thought might happen, and what they need to be prepared for. And so I, you know, just those two examples alone, trying to take that and emulate that in my own leadership.
So we've talked a little bit around the edges of your real core work that you actually advise on, sort of the three main themes of your, what I think you call the essential ingredients for authentic and impactful leadership. They are cultivating a journaling practice for self-discovery, reading for leadership growth, and focusing on emotional intelligence and attention management. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what these ingredients are and why they're important for leadership? You've already touched on it a little bit in terms of the kinds of answers to the previous questions. Also, I mentioned to you in the pre-show that I just read a recent blog post of yours that you talked about decision-making, and you really advise that if you use journaling, you can actually get the data for how effective your decisions are if you actually go back and look at it. So talk to us a little about those three main themes.
Green, I've been dealing with these green notebooks now for 20 years, but I would say it wasn't until about 4 years ago that I was like, I need to start using these to, instead of just capturing all the data from organizational meetings, I need to start using them to capture the data for my own life. And so I think it was beginning of 2021, I started journaling for the very first time, the daily habit of journaling. And what I found was before that, let's say like I'd misplace my keys, right? Like I would blow up, you know, I'd have a blow up. I'd be very angry, whatever. And until I started journaling and like, why was I angry? You know, I really didn't understand the core of a lot of what was going on in my life. There's a great quote by John Gardner that I almost use and said, by midlife, most of us are accomplished fugitives from ourselves. And you know, and especially as a leader, you're busy, you're going 100 miles an hour. For me, I was working 70 hours a week. So it's really hard to pay attention to yourself. So I started journaling. And over time, like, you start noticing patterns. If you write something down enough, you start noticing patterns in your own life. And what I found was that, like, I could start honing in on, you know, when I made so one of the things I wrote in that post that you're talking about, like, if I felt like I was losing control, like, let's say there was a situation where I no longer had any decision space in it, like, I just had to execute, I would make some very gut, maybe sometimes irrational decisions based on that. But like, until I started paying attention, observing that, I couldn't tell you that. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that. It would have just been, this is what happens or whatever. But like, being able to know that, I can now set up things prior to that happening to prevent me from doing something dumb when that particular type of context happens. Or I know, and my wife will say something to me. She's like, hey, it looks like you're spinning right now. Like, you might want to slow down a little bit, which goes back to the thing that we were talking about in the beginning, is having that good support network. But, you know, it's those things that we capture in our journals, you know, that really help you kind of understand and see yourself. And it gives you data to start pulling from and start looking. You know, you talked about My Green Notebook at the very beginning. We wrote that because in the military, you change positions every year, every 2 years. Like, this last 2 years was the longest I've held a single job in the military, because I've had a career of careers. And so we created My Green Notebook to look at 30 different attributes of leadership, and to be able to take 30 days and reflect on those and kind of write things down so you could capture all those lessons, whether it's about communication, stress management, who you trust, who you don't trust, in a written journal, so you can go back and have that data for when you go to the next job. You can kind of see, you know, you can kind of take what you've learned and turn that experience into wisdom. And so that was like one thing. And a few weeks ago, I was like, you know what? I want to create a book that is based off my journaling habits. So I created the Leader's 90-Day Notebook. And every day for 90 days, you know, you're looking at how much sleep you got. This is how I journal, how much sleep I got, what my energy level. I wear a Whoop that kind of gives me like a red, yellow, green percentage every morning when I wake up. And so I know as soon as I wake up what kind of day I'm going to have. But, you know, writing that down, writing down key decisions I made, so I can go back and look 6 months, you know, a year later and say, was that a good decision? And like the context for that decision, writing down things that I'm struggling with. You know, that was a really important part of journaling for me, was if I'm really struggling with something, writing it out. And I found two things happen. One, sometimes it will lose its power over me when I actually write it down and see it, because I'm like, man, this is dumb. Why am I stressing out over this thing? Or two, once I get past that thing, once I solve that problem and I can go back, you know, like 6-7 months later and look back and be like, man, I thought the world was crashing down. I didn't think I was going to make it through that. And I did. It kind of becomes a source of resilience. At least it did for me. It becomes a source of resilience as I continue on to the next problem. Looking at that, looking at lessons learned, looking at gratitude and looking at what you accomplished. That's another thing. I don't know about you, but I sometimes minimize the things that I accomplish, because I'm always looking elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so just to be able to write those things down and kind of go back every now and then, just be like, hey, I did some good last week, or I did some good last month. So I just printed at Green Notebook Press this 90-day journal about 2 weeks ago. And it's awesome. It's already sold 140 copies around the world too, which is pretty cool. So, but I think those are really important, because once you start doing that practice of journaling and capturing that data, you can then take it and get a much clearer picture of who you are as a leader, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, what you value, which I think is really important, especially when it comes to making career decisions. And then the thing that you were talking about, like the emotional intelligence and the decision-making, all of those things start getting better from that practice.
And I imagine you also really need to do it like immediately. We did an episode on the podcast a few episodes ago talking about how our brain works, and that we have biases, we have incorrect recall, you know, the whole eyewitness testimony research that talks about, if you're going to look at what you did a few months in the future, if you didn't write it down, you're going to reconstruct it in all kinds of different ways. But if you journal every day, you're going to be able to capture the exact, well, I wasn't all that rested that day. That might have been the factor that led to this decision being a bad one, but you have to capture it on the day, right?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I don't recommend this, but there's been times where my wife and I've gotten in arguments and I'm like, that didn't happen. And she's like, yeah, it did. And then I'll go back and grab a journal and prove one of us, right, don't do that. But yeah, I think I've noticed too that the sting of things also starts going away with time. So there's things that I've kind of, that, you know, maybe happened that day that were a pain point for me in that moment. But a day or two later, like I kind of forget about, but they were kind of important things to write down. So I try to do that. And then you're right. The further we get away from an experience, every time we recall it, we restructure it a little bit, make it a little bit different, and then put it back in our memory. And so several months later, it's completely different. And so that's, you know, having right now 4 years of or 3 years of journals, I'm able to go back and look and be like, wow, that did not happen the way I thought it would. And so I saw a quote the other day by Robert Caro that said that people lie, but paper doesn't. And I think that's a really cool way to think about journaling. You know, again, as you're talking about looking back at journal entries from a month or a year later.
We're both avid readers as well. I actually go through probably more than two or three books a week these days. I actually listen to them because even for this show, interviewing authors and I need to read the books and the like. And so I often listen to them. But I've also been convinced that the only way to really stay on top of everything is to take the time to read, get other people's ideas and the like. And you made the point that if you want to make a difference in not only relying on the experience that you've learned from others, you can get new ideas by reading. Talk to us a little about your own experience with reading and how you've applied it.
Again, this goes back to, for leaders, you know, you never know the example you set, how it's going to affect the people that work for you. I was very fortunate. I worked for a captain when I was a lieutenant, brand new in the Army. Been in the Army like 6 months. And he told me time and time again about the importance of reading for military officers, how it's our job to study the profession. So he kind of started it. I had some other mentors along the way that continued to reinforce it. And then I think about 8 years in, I started working for, at the time, Major General H.R. McMaster. And he would come in every Monday, super excited. And he would ask me, hey, did you read this? Did you read that? You got to read this. And he would explain why. But his enthusiasm was so contagious that I would go home every night and fill up my Amazon cart with books. So I started reading. And at first, especially, you know, depending on what your reading interests are, it would take me about 6 months to get through a book. Especially, you know, like when we're talking military history, it's not the most interesting. A lot of it's very dry, but it's very important. It's like literary vegetables for your brain. And so it would take me a while. So then I started picking up this idea of reading multiple books at the same time. And my reading went from 4 to 5 books a year, all the way up to now, I think I'm up to like 38 or something like that for this year. And I've been in very busy jobs. That's the other crazy thing. So, you know, anywhere between 40 and 50 books a year, working 70 hours a week. And so, you know, when you look at the 20, 30 minutes in the morning, I'll sit down and I'll have a stack of 3 or 4 books. So like right now, reading a book by Robert Caro called Working, I may read 5-10 pages of it. I'll put it down. I'll pick up this other book by Chase Jarvis. I'll read that for 5-10 minutes, put that down, pick up a book about reflections of a POW in Vietnam. Read that for a couple minutes, put it down, pick up a good book by Joseph McCormick called Quiet Works, read that for 4 or 5 minutes, and I'll put it down. And so that 30 minutes, I'm constantly reading. Whereas before, you know, I may read one book, start reading the same line over and over again, and then I put it down. So I found that this like kind of crop rotation of books in that 30 minute window I have to read has introduced me to tons of different ideas over the course of my career. And I've been able to bring things in that aren't necessarily related to the military into my job because of it. And so that's probably been one of the practices, I think, for me, besides writing and journaling, that have completely altered, you know, the course of my career, especially this last decade.
I find too, Joe, that after I've read something and I tend to blog about it, and you also blog now as well, that I really appreciate the kind of engagement you get after you put your ideas out there. Some of the time it's just like, hey, great, I agree with you. Some of the time I'll come in and actually have a disagreement, which I really welcome because it makes your thought exercise go even deeper. And so talk to us a little bit about not just your journaling, but also even your blogging and the whole platform that you've developed that a lot of people are engaged with.
Going back to the time working for McMaster, this was 2012. He thought that we should have an online platform where military leaders could learn about books, engage with each other, potentially post articles, stuff like that. But the funny thing about the military is like, it's a bureaucracy. And so at the time, you'd have thought we were trying to build a new tank out of parts from an Ace Hardware. And so, you know, like I was very frustrated with that process. We were hitting bureaucratic red tape every step of the way. And I started getting the idea that maybe I could do this same thing on my own and have much better success. So created a blog, wrote with anonymously for a while because I was so scared. Because at the time, you know, to put your ideas out there in the military profession, especially with the jobs that I was doing, was it just didn't make sense to a lot of people. You know, we pull triggers, we don't write things down. And so I did it honestly. I was so scared of getting blowback from it. And I wasn't even writing anything critical. I was writing about things that interested me and that I thought would help others. But after 6 months of watching this anonymous guy get a lot of accolades from people, that my ego took over. And I was like, all right, I need me to put my name up against it. So it started out as a personal blog. Friends started saying, hey, I'd like to write something too. Can I post something on there? I said, sure. And then eventually I started getting emails from people I didn't even know asking if they could submit something. And I said, sure. And then next thing you know, I think we've had like 2.4, 2.6 million visitors over the last decade. And we have a team of volunteers from across the military that help edit these pieces from people and post on the blog. And so it's, you know, this is the most I've written, the couple pieces I've written lately is the most I've actually written on the website itself in a long time, because it went from being my personal blog to belonging to the military. And it's kind of become like a Harvard Business Review written by practitioners in the military. So it's a really great resource from, you know, written by men and women who are practicing leadership on a daily basis and thinking about it and combining their experiences with stuff that they're reading.
I want to reinforce another thing that you just mentioned that I think is an attribute of great leaders. I often hear people say, somebody should do something about that.
Yeah.
And I always say, why not me? Or why right. not us? And so I think you did the same thing. And so I think that's another real great kind of attribute of great leaders, I think, to be able to say, you know what? Nobody else might be doing this, but why not me?
Yeah, and everybody's different. You know, but for me doing this, it did not feel comfortable at all doing it. I just felt this draw that it needed to be done. And it's funny, like, you know, we're getting ready for command. We're living in North Carolina. I'm about to move my family to Germany. I know I only have a couple years left of, you know, 2 years left in the military. And I also know that I don't want to lose from the Green Notebook. I don't want the blog, the podcast, the newsletters to die. So I'm trying to like think through in my head, how am I going to do this thing over the next 2 years? And my wife goes, you know, she's like, what are you going to do? And I go, I like had this like freak out moment. I'm like, I don't know, because nobody else has done this. I don't have anybody else's example to look up to and say, well, this person did these things. And so I think, you know, when you do say, why not me? Know that it's not going to be sunshine and rainbows after that. Like you're signing up for a lot, but in the end, it's way more rewarding than if you'd have just sat back and watched other people do it or not do it.
So you've spent more than 20 years in the military and leadership, senior leadership roles, and you've also been interviewing people in outside of the military and civilian life. A lot of the lessons are obviously transferable, the things I think we've talked about on this interview. What differences have you seen between leadership in the military versus civilian life?
I've been thinking about that a lot. It's really hard because, like, you know, I think everything's relative. You know, like a lot of military leaders will say, well, you know, the decisions we make are, you know, life and death. So, you know, maybe the risk for what we do is a little different. Like, you know, when we're making decisions where people are moving, you know, multi-ton vehicles around a simulated battlefield, you know, the risk of injury is very high. So I think that's in the back of a lot of our minds when we do it. But everything else is the exact same. I mean, like, it's a leadership is a people human endeavor. And I think it's all relative. Like, so the things that you thought were important to you at IBM is equal to the things that I thought were important to me in the military. And I guarantee you that we both attacked those things with the same fervor and the same, you know, motivation, and we face, you know, similar challenges. The more and more that, like, I think about it, Carl, I think that, like, it's all relative. I just think the risk for us, you know, is potentially higher, you know, depending on what we're doing. But I think the skills and something else that's different too is you can't fire, you know, people in the military. You know, like, it takes a lot. You can, but it takes a lot. It takes a lot of work. And so, you know, you can't just get rid of somebody that you're not working with. And people aren't going to leave if they just don't like the organization because they signed a contract. And so you've got to manage a little bit differently because, you know, you can't walk away and they can't walk away. So you just got to make it work. So I think maybe that's another difference that I would add in there.
So just in wrapping up, one of the things we like to do on this podcast is try to give really practical advice for somebody listening, has been listening to all the advice that you've been giving. What can they do later today, tomorrow, that can be one thing that will get them in the direction that you've been advising that they do?
I would say just sit down, whether it's with a notebook, a legal pad, or something, and just write down your thoughts at the end of the day. Just try it one time. And then do it again tomorrow, and then do it again the day after that. And I really do think that over the course of time that you will be able to start paying attention to things that you want to pay attention to. You will have awareness of the things that maybe you didn't have awareness of before, and you'll actually be able to take a more deliberate approach to life and leadership than you would if you were just kind of going through the motions every day.
Spot on. So just in wrapping up, we've mentioned the many things that you do. How can somebody go and find your material, find your blog, your podcast, being in contact with you? Where should they go?
Yeah, so fromthegreennotebook.com is our website. You'll have sign up there. We have the monthly reading list newsletter. I've been putting it out since 2017, and it's 3 to 4 books I read each month. And that's another good device to keep you reading every month because you have to produce this newsletter. So that's something that I've been doing. And I try to, like, it's not just books that I read. It's books that I read that I think other people would benefit from. And so I'll spend a couple hundred words just talking about why I think this book's important. So that's one. Two, you know, we talked about, we have the Sunday email, which is this weekly reflection email that I put out. I usually start out with a quote that I found somewhere. And then just talk about the application to your life. Podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Instagram too, at, you know, From the Green Notebook, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And people can reach out to me on LinkedIn, or they can find me. My email address is on the website too, and reach out.
Joe, this has been a great conversation. Thank you ever so much for engaging in it and sharing all the advice that you did.
Thank you so much, Carl. This is awesome. Congratulations again on your recent retirement as well.
And you too. I wish you all the best with it. Thanks so much,
Joe. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you to contribute what you can financially, either as a one-time payment with our tip jar, or better yet, select a recurring monthly contribution. Just click on the tip jar link or the support the podcast link in the show notes. You can also go to our website, lifehabitspodcast.com, and click on the Support the Podcast tab. Doing that will ensure that Paige and I will be able to continue to bring this podcast to you each week. I've never had advertising or asked for contributions during my previous 16 years because it wasn't my job. This is Paige's job. And so I would greatly appreciate it if you could consider contributing financially to the podcast. Thanks so much. Visit our website, lifehabitspodcast.com, to sign up for our newsletter, get in touch with us, and find our social media pages. If you love our podcast, please give us a rating in the app you're listening to us on, follow us, and share us with your friends. And with that, Paige and I would like to thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you found it helpful. We appreciate you. We'll talk to you next time, and bye for now.